Welcome everyone to the October 23rd Women in the Economy Commission meeting. First item of business is the approval of minutes from the September meeting. Did everyone have a chance to take a look at those? Yes? Great. May I have a motion?
Motion to accept the minutes.
Second. Really?
Mm-hmm. For the recording. Motion by Ms. Barnett,
second by Jane.
Dr. Robinson, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Second item on the agenda, well, not on the agenda, but I'll take the prerogative of the chair pro tem, is the introduction of our newest member, Heather Varma. Heather, please take a moment to introduce yourself.
Thank you. I am so excited to be here. It's something I'm very passionate about that women can excel and have successful careers. And it's something that I'm just looking forward to contributing in a positive way. I work for a firm called HDR. It's an engineering and design firm. I am not an engineer, but I work in the communication side of things. So when we design large infrastructure projects, I'm the one on the ground with the stakeholders, creating the communication strategy, the messaging, and coordinating media efforts, anything from A to Z with making sure the public is engaged and aware of the project. So that's something that I hope to also contribute here is communication is so valid and important with the efforts of this group that I hope to be able to help you put together that communication strategy and make sure people know the good work that's happening here and also just the needs of women in the economy here. And personally, I have a daughter that I hope will be just a tremendous person in her life. She's 6 right now, and I have a son who's 4, and my husband is a fire captain, and my daughter hopes to be a firefighter when she grows up.
Thank you. We look forward to having you as part of our discussion and work product. Next item on the agenda, Ms. Main, data update for fields of study by gender.
Thank you, Representative Dewey. From our last meeting, I had presented some data on degrees of study and degree attainment. We wanted to know the nature of the fields of study that women were pursuing in Utah relative to men. I presented that data, and the logical next step and request that was made of me was to then examine wages for that data. So I assigned one of our research economists to review this data. Just to give a little background on it, once we have this data is from the current population survey, which surveys 700 Utahns. It's very small, is the point I'm making. She did conduct a study. So we take those degree holders. So this is a subset of the Utah adult population. It's anyone who holds a bachelor's degree or higher. We then subset it again by only full-time year-round workers so that we're attempting to compare apples to apples as much as possible. And then these degree holders who are also full-time year-round workers, we compared their wages. One thing to keep in mind is, and many of you may be an example of this in your own work, is field of study and field of work don't always match. So my life idea, I studied economics and I'm an economist, but I'm in meetings and interacting with people all the time who have degrees in history and are now, you know, finance managers. And so The data, this is a different data set that I have projected up here. I'm just giving you some background. But we did do that by field of study, and it showed that for those workers with bachelor's degree or higher, we had a 68% wage gap. So the wage gap that you hear usually in the news, these are all workers. So for the degree holders that are full-time year-round, all, not controlling for field of study, the gap was 68%, so it was a little bit larger. The largest gap was in the field of study for the men and women whose field of study was English language and literature, where the males were making approximately 250% of the female wage. So also in the largest gap, second largest gap was in family and consumer sciences, where male wages were just over $80,000 and the female wages were $39,000. The statistical validity of the data we are presenting that data which is statistically valid, but it was not strong. Margins of error were very high on this data, and that's why I'm not presenting it to you. I'm just summarizing verbally. So what data we do have that has strong statistical significance that I can present to you as an alternative is not by fields of study, but instead by occupations. And this is the data I have displayed up here. I apologize that it's very small. But this is a really very interesting tool that my economist in my shop built. It's a data visualization tool, interactive. And we have it linked on the Women in the Economy Commission website. So if any of you ever need references for any outreach you're doing or research or presentations you're doing, this is a very rich data set. It really has what you need. But I'm here in the particular tab called Earnings and Poverty. This is earnings for year-round full-time workers for different occupational groups. So management, the wage gap is 71%, for example. The next one down, and again, I apologize that this is so small. Business and financial operations, the gap is 68%. A very small gap exists in the construction and extraction workers, 95%. That's one thing that we ought to really be thinking about moving forward is where these gaps are smallest and largest. Legal occupations, 49%. And as I said, it's an occupational group. So legal occupations is going to include not only lawyers, but legal secretaries and paralegals. So there's probably a little more detail that would need to be siphoned out in order to really get to the gap. But clearly, I mean, just controlling for occupational choice, which is something that we've talked about before, controlling for that is not making the gap disappear. The gap still exists even when you control for and compare people in different occupational groups. If you want really quick, I can kind of click through. I get questions from some of you here and there for data, and this really is the tool where I go to get your answers. So if you ever wanted to, you can get labor force participation data. And as you can see here, you can drill this down to counties. So if you're ever needing to speak specifically to a particular area in the state, you can drill in that way. Then the earnings and poverty data is in here. Here are poverty rates by gender and education levels. Educational attainment is in here as well. More data on the occupational differences. And then also on industries and hours worked. So that's my update. We can continue the discussion, and I can, of course, field questions about this data and any other further analysis we may need in order to develop out our recommendations and build stronger arguments for our matrix. Dr. Robinson?
Okay, thank you. Carrie, can you tell me, is it possible that we can dive further down in those occupation codes? For example, the legal one, there's clearly a big gap between the women in that occupation code. But we know there's a lot of occupations that fall within that broad category. Secretaries, paralegals, lawyers. Can you dive down so that we can compare lawyers to lawyers by gender, paralegal to paralegal by gender, and so forth?
For some occupations, you can. For the full breadth of occupations, no, the statistical validity just fades completely. I can have my staff go through and find which ones stand up to statistical testing, where the margins of error are not too wide, but we display it in here at the most detailed level that we can and still reach the full gamut of the occupational groups, but I can go and see for which occupation we have statistical validity on the gap data.
Chairman Felix, I'd like to ask for that to be done because I think the gap can be misleading in those occupational codes. And if we can get data at a lower level that we can feel confident in and you feel that we're not at a too small of a sample, I think that would be helpful.
I think that would be great. How does that work within the parameters of what the Division of Workforce Services is doing? Like, how basically, what kind of a time commitment or whatever does it take to do this? Can we have this by next meeting? Is this something that's a deeper dive, or what is this?
This doesn't spit out in the normal data tables. We would have to use the PUMS microdata and do our own analysis. So I think it's probably possible to have it for our December 19th meeting. So we'll work on that, and I'll see if we can schedule that into our work.
Okay, great. Dr. Robinson, did you have any follow-up on that? Or?
I do. I have another question. Can we talk about the wage gap by education as well? I saw that up on your first slide, I think.
It's over here. I apologize for the size of this print, but here it is, the gap on the earnings by education level. This first category here is, that's everyone. For less than a high school graduate, the gap is 64%. High school graduate or GED, 58%. Some college or associate's degree, 55%. Bachelor's degree, 57%. And then graduate or professional degree, 66% on that. So this is something I think we're doing individual correlations between gap and single variables, but we're not doing the interaction, and I think that's something that maybe is a little bit, it's different, is we don't have the gap for a difference in those who hold a bachelor's degree, a man and a woman who hold a bachelor's degree in accounting who work as accountants. We know the difference in bachelor's degrees, we know the difference in wages in accounting, but we don't have the interaction terms on these, just for clarification. But it, what's interesting, and I think a pattern that holds, is nothing's ever 100%.
Well, how do we get the interaction, and what do you mean by nothing's ever 100%?
I mean that no matter, all these different ways that we slice it, we never go, oh, well, that group, they do have equal pay. What it tells me is that even if we did have the interaction terms, I don't think the gap would go to zero, is my thing. To do that, that's an econometric analysis that we could do. It would take longer than the December. It would probably take about 6 months for us to perform a research project like that, and I would probably, before I could commit to it, would have to ensure that the data supports it, that we have the data set robust enough to perform something like that, but that's a potential research project that could be assigned to my research team.
Could we have a parking lot of things we want with what your estimated like things that we want, and then in lay language, what it is that we're looking for through that technical request.
So this is what we want, and this is what it would tell us?
With some of the discussion related to the data, very technical and precise and appropriate terminology is being used. So I'm just asking for a column that can explain that it's not in technical language.
Okay.
And then another column that's the estimate of what it would take, like 5 minutes or 6 months. And then maybe we can take a look at that and see if it's too much of a workload for DWS, if that might be an opportunity for more participation from a university or from a member, an entity in the private sector that might do research or to get some help getting the deep dive on these questions. And I think that, we are all committed to seeing action, and that's part of what we're going to be talking about with the matrix. I also know that the hard questions that we're asking here to unpeel these data sets are extraordinarily valuable, too. I think a lot of this discussion out in the public it's divided people into camps in a lot of ways, and at some point people stop listening. And so if we can be as clear and exact as possible, then that helps relate one to the public, and it also helps us target what it is that we want to do. So it's not just gathering information to gather information. There's an end goal to it. So that would be helpful. Again, three columns, the very precise technical ask, the next column so it's accessible to the layperson, and then the third column, what that takes from a time and financial resource type's perspective. Dr. Robinson, we have two. I know that other people have questions as well too. I'm not shutting you off. I'm just acknowledging people so that they know that they're being heard.
I think it'd be helpful if Carrie develops this list, this table, if she also is clear about what limitations there are for doing that. For example, when she has to combine variables on education and occupation code, she's going to probably come down to a very small sample and she'd have a really wide margin of error. That's important for us to understand that the data is very limited in what we can get from it.
Great, thank you. Anything else on that? Ms. Burkholder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two clarifying questions. One is that you had mentioned that there was a sample size of 700, I believe. Is that for all of this, all of these data, or was that referring to something else?
It's for all of
That's for all of Utah. The total sample for Utah in the current population survey is right around 700. So that's what's used to analyze this. I don't know the total number of respondents who are male versus female, or the total number of respondents who had sales-related jobs. But we don't, here, nothing's being published with an N smaller than 5. Some of those numbers I was quoting to you when I performed the research that was requested from from the last meeting did have N smaller than 5, and that's why I wasn't. That's why we didn't print it and distribute it. But this is probably data that's more sound. And when we do the single variable analysis, it can be used without too wide margins of error.
Okay, thank you. And the other question was about the accessibility of this information. Can you remind me how we gain access to the Women in the Economy website? If we wanted to go back to our offices and pull this up. Would we go to TWS, and then there would be an obvious place to go for the commission website and an obvious way to get to this page?
I can, I'll navigate right now. So TWS homepage, department, associations and partnerships. Women in the Economy Commission. This is the link to the data tool.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Burkholder. Ms. Hiring.
Thanks, Representative Seeling. This is more a comment before we ask Carrie's department to take on more responsibility and more action. From my perspective, we have a lot of data already, maybe even too much for us to really comprehend extensively. And before we make the request for more, I would really like to get more information, as Representative Seeley pointed out, about having an end goal. Because I think we're adequately prepared at this point to take action on a lot of data that we already have. So I don't know that there would be significant advantages in asking Carrie's team to do more.
I appreciate that point. So we're not gathering just to gather. I can say that related to the wage gap, that in particular, to get as specific and precise as possible is helpful. People, policymakers, cloud out when the phrase wage gap is mentioned, and they justified it in their heads in some way that it does not exist. And they will throw things out there like tenure, related to tenure, or women choose to not have careers that don't pay as much. I mean, there's this mantra of non-fact-based understanding, which was a problem in even getting this bill passed.
And I've been a part of many of very similar conversations. So I do see the value of getting to the data and being really precise about it. I just want to make sure that we're clear on what the end goal is when we ask Carrie's team to compile it. Is it to have a more accurate measure of pay gap so that we're able to speak to it accurately, or is it, what is the end goal that we're asking for?
Okay, so how about a column, and I appreciate that too, so how about a column, the so what question? Like, why do we care? Why does it matter? To the work that we're doing. What is it tied to? What is it connect to? With one of the action goals or whatever. Does that work?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, it works.
Cool.
It all works. I just want to make sure that we're spending time on the appropriate things.
I think that's an excellent point. Thank you. I will now, as Chair Pro Tem, turn the time over to the Chair, Speaker Lockhart.
Thank you, Representative. I was just going to make a comment in the sense we're talking about the data and that. I think something that might be helpful, what we're looking at is a lot of quantitative data, right, numbers and so forth. What we're not looking at is the qualitative data or what's really happening. Put it this way. Maybe something that would be helpful for us is to hear from maybe some HR managers of some local companies about the experiences, maybe what they see that I just know that Representative Seeley and I have been, you know, speaking at various things and talking about these issues, and some of the feedback that I've received is why don't you listen, or you know, allow some HR directors who are daily dealing with people who come in, men and women, you know, whoever, the employees who come in and say, I need this time off, or I'm going to take this leave, or I'm going to quit because of this or that or whatever, and maybe that can help us get some of the qualitative data that we might need. Is that something that the commission would be interested in?
I think that's a really wise decision. When everything can match quantitative data with qualitative data, it makes for a stronger argument. And as we're thinking about the strategy going forward here into the next year, I think that's really valuable. I would be more than happy to ask the team at the University of Utah to think through a research plan so that we can gather the qualitative data in a way that you can feel confident in the results that we provide.
Right. And so we know we just don't want anecdotes,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Anecdotes aren't data.
Right. And maybe by the December meeting, we could come with a couple of strategy options that we could present to the committee and see if that could be of help. In them.
So, is that of interest to the commission? If there's not objection, we'll ask you to do that.
Okay.
Representative Seeley?
I also think that's a good idea. In our first meeting, Senator Henderson had brought of some experiences that she had related to all of this that were somewhat unexpected by many of us, just related to workforce and what was a barrier that I've never seen identified in any type of quant presentation, related to norms of going out to lunch with colleagues and maybe it's not her being told that it wasn't appropriate for her to join in because it was she's a female, was a group of males. And so particularly related to cultural nuance about what people have lived, their lived experience, as well as what they want, I think that would be very helpful too. Thanks.
I was just going to suggest that we have Ms. Irene consult on that as well as an HR manager with extensive experience. I would think you could probably contribute a lot to the design of questions and so maybe collaborating with Dr. Robinson would be apropos.
I'm happy to.
You only have so many on, or they all turn off.
Oh, I don't know if I'm doing it right yet.
You're doing it.
Okay. I was going to offer my help as well. I do a lot of market research in my career as well, and I run focus groups, and so there might be some value I can contribute.
That's great. Okay, with that, I think we're going to move on. I don't think. We are going to move on. Item number three, the matrix collaboration, and I think Ms. May have that's yours. So, go ahead.
Go for it, then.
Just to bring us all up to speed, I've created this as a shared document on a Google Drive. You've all been, should have received an invitation to access. Please let me know if you're having any trouble with that. I do have verification from several of you that you've been able to access it. And I have implemented some feedback. And one of the biggest changes I made was, I hope that I can get the group's help on this. My vision of this, and talking with our communications expert, Ms. Barham, my vision of this is to try and frame it in a solutions manner. This all hopefully will flow to solutions. So solutions that are identified as we, because we have
correctly define the root causes, not the problems per se, but the root causes. My feeling is that, especially as I've seen our two co-chairs go out into the community to deliver this message, I've seen that you use the terminology pay gap or inequality, I think is the other one Representative Seeley brought to my attention. You use this language and it sort of shuts people off. So instead of, my vision is that the commission ought not to try to develop a policy to fix the pay gap, but instead fix the root cause of the pay gap. And I think if we're talking about those things, those are true solutions. I can't envision a policy that says Utahns will no longer be allowed to pay a woman less than a man. That just doesn't sound like a solution. It's completely illogical. So I'm trying to get at root causes here. But what I've noticed is that in doing so, I think I've clouded the drive that we have. So to based on some feedback and some collaboration I did with Heather, Ms. Barnum, I noticed that maybe what I ought to do is say, which of these conditions what does it tie back to in terms of challenges? So I call those things economic barriers. So for example, one of these that we had already on here was cultural norms of male-female socializing become barriers to career networking. I wrote that one specifically off of Senator Henderson's personal example. I call that economic barrier a fairness in opportunity. I label that as fairness in opportunity is the barrier that creates. A measure is that I suggested and was male-female trends in C-level and management positions. And partners of my thought on that is Salt Lake Chamber as a potential partner in finding a solution. What that solution is, I don't know. And that's where the items blank. So I would like us to do a few things here today. Some of you have brought to me some really great ideas. They just came a little bit later, so I thought, can you bring them to the commission and we can all discuss, and I will type as you guys speak. The other thing is, what maybe can we do to reframe if necessary, reframe this matrix so everyone feels as though it really does speak to the mission, goals, and what drives this commission.
Thank you. That's great. I really like the matrix. So this is for all of us to discuss together, our ideas and input into this. I see no light, so let's move on. No, you have to learn how to do that. No light. Could everyone please? I apologize. I'm dealing with a migraine right at this moment, so I can't really see her. Can you turn your names this way so that I have some attempt at getting your names right? I know we're all consistent. Okay. All right. These names on the chart are legislator names, so I could call you Senator Maine, but I'm guessing that's not who you are. So, Ms. Fulton?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have several items, so if I could give a couple now and then a couple of later, maybe that would help. In terms of, you, Ms. Maine, will know where to place all of these things, but in terms of the issues, I missed reference to both earnings and economic security on that list of identified issues, and they seem to me to be so critical. So I don't know whether you have included them implicitly somehow under that list of four, but I wonder whether we could be more explicit about that. So that's one comment under the identified issues that you have on the matrix.
I agree. I think those are items that are missing. My question back to you is, should it be a condition, or are these more,
Are they conditions? Are they issues? Are they... what I hope is that the conditions are things that we can see a path to a solution. I'm not sure economic security has a one specific solution. I see it as a broader challenge, and then we need to, but what we would need to do is what causes economic insecurity, and those become the conditions that we could see policy program commission gives consultation on these things.
I agree. I don't see what I just said as a condition, but as one of the identified issues above the conditions.
Okay.
Yeah, I did not understand them as conditions.
Okay.
But as issues.
And then one other comment about economic barriers, and I'll be quiet for a minute before I talk about some of the conditions that I saw. In terms of economic barriers, you listed fairness in pay. And my question when I saw that was whether you intended to include minimum wage, living wage issues in that, or whether that is a different sort of thing. It's a different category that could not be included in that barrier. So that's one comment. And the other is about the work-life balance economic barrier. And the question is, did you intend for that to cover work-family supports, which seem to me to be slightly different than work-life balance? But again, those may have been implicit in your list, but I wondered about that. Whether they were different sorts of things, different kinds of barriers.
Madam Speaker, Chair, I have a clarifying question for Ms. Burkholder. What do you help me understand the difference between work-life balance and work-life support?
I'm no expert on this, but
So
here is my attempt to describe the difference. To me, a work-life support is something that assists a woman who needs or wants to work in doing that. So, for example, affordable child care would be a work-life support. And when I think of work-life balance, I think more in terms of flexibility in the hours of an occupation. But arguably that could be work-life, that could be a work-life, a work-family support as well. So that's part of the origin of my question. I don't know whether all of those things are subsumed under work-life balance or if there are some genuine differences between them that we need to distinguish.
Madam Speaker, Chairman, Ms. Irene, from an HR perspective, because this makes sense to me, the unpacking of it, just within like the last 30 seconds, I've started to think differently about this. Because it's not only affordable child care and work-life support, it could also be elder care, elder day, whatever is needed. So from an HR perspective, how are those issues divided, differentiated, identified within the industry?
Oh, I thought I had the right one.
Press your button.
Got it. I think I got the right one. Did it come on?
Yeah.
Okay. I just didn't count it.
So, Representative Seelig, it's a great question, and one thing from an HR perspective that I can attest to is that progressive, thoughtful, forward-thinking companies have this idea on their minds all the time from a recruiting and a retention standpoint. So thinking about things, I call it work-life integration. more so the balance, because I don't know that anything can ever be fully balanced, but how women in the workplace can have families and have careers and integrate both of those as seamlessly as possible. Does that include for many support issues? Yes. And from an HR perspective, many companies offer subsidized support for child care. They offer flexible spending accounts for child care and elder care, and different programs depending on the level of commitment from their leadership to make all of that a benefit for working at that particular company. So do all companies think that way? No. Is that one way that this commission can have an impact? Absolutely. And it's my intention that the company that I work for, Zions Bank Corporation, we are in the process of becoming a leader in this, and more to come in the next meeting in November about how we're going to really take a leadership approach to addressing these issues for women in the workplace. Does that get to what you were asking?
Yes, it does. It helps. And I personally like the phrase work-life integration. I think that it, it takes us out of the familiar phrase of work-life balance, because I think that maybe for a lot of people that cease to have a certain kind of meaning now, and I like how it's also more inclusive of other types of family choices. Maybe it's paternal family leave and things like that as well too, which impacts us all. So thank you for that clarification.
Anyone else?
Is yours still on?
I think it's still on.
It's
green. Then it's on. Thank you, Madam Chair.
There, I had a few comments about the conditions, and again, the semantics of this you're going to need to help me with. So let me just read through this, and then maybe you can help explain really what I'm trying to say. The first is something that we've already addressed today, which is the reference. I didn't see any reference to the earnings ratio between men and women, the gender wage gap, that language. I understand that causes problems, but we are among us, so I'm just using this language. And the information about median annual earnings, all of which we saw today. And then reiterating that comment that although some differences may be explained by occupational choice, it's my understanding that that doesn't explain it all the way. So what I didn't see in the matrix was some sort of reference to that issue itself. There were a number of things that seemed to touch upon it, but talking about that directly I didn't see. So that's one thing to consider. Another reference that I missed in the conditions was references to minimum wage or living wage for lack of other language and the problems that are created by women workers in minimum wage jobs who are unable to pay for basic necessities for themselves and their families, such as decent housing. And then that forces them to seek public benefits if they're eligible to make up the difference. But the challenge is that if we have any sector of the economy that has an unskilled layer of workers that is earning so little that they can't afford their own necessities, which they really want to do, and they're forced to apply for public benefits, those corporations or businesses are in effect asking the government to make up the difference for the wage that they are not earning, and then the workers themselves it's a blameworthy sort of thing. They are blamed because they can't support their families on what they're earning, but they want to, and they're hardworking. And there's a whole cluster of issues that I think is connected with what unskilled workers earn, and it's a structural issue in terms of the economy that I think is a really difficult issue for women in particular. And we see it with women who've had to leave their homes because of violence, that they are not educated enough or do not have enough work experience or have not been allowed to work, and they can only get minimum wage jobs and they can't even afford an apartment. So there's something about the way that we are understanding wages that is trapping women. And I'd like to get at that somehow because I think it's important. But I missed references to all of that. A third thing is the linkage between educational attainment and salaries and wages. So we began to see some of those data today, but I think it needs to be explicit. We talked about educational attainment in the matrix, but I think the link needs to be clear that higher educational levels for women can bring higher salaries and wages, and that is part of the solution that we're looking at is trying to make it possible for more women to complete their education because there's such an economic link there. Another one is references to the issue of economic security for women and poverty rates for women, especially single women with children. And as Representative Selig said earlier, this is another phrase that is sometimes conjures up some really pejorative perceptions of these women. And again, they may be forced into singlehood after marriage and family. But that is their category. They're single women with children, but they may have been forced into that because of abuse and violence, for example. So that link between economic security and poverty rates and who we're really talking about being in poverty in Utah, the feminization of poverty, that sort of thing. Then, sorry, I'm talking a lot, but there are just a couple more things and then I'll stop. We talked in the matrix about, had an entry here about minority women experiencing additional challenges in the labor force. I think those racial and ethnic disparities are larger than that. They're not simply within the labor force. We see them in employment and earnings and in educational attainment and in economic security. So simply focusing on them in the labor force itself doesn't address some of these larger areas where we see really significant disparities among racial and ethnic minorities, women in Utah, that has an economic impact. And then two more things. Do we need to acknowledge anywhere in this work the economic impact of healthcare? And that may be changing in good ways. There's still more work to be done. And I don't know what that intersection is with the work of this commission, but I think all of us understand that at least to a certain extent there is an impact on that. And finally, as I look through these, maybe this is something that the commission will be able to get some information on, and it has to do with Utah's economic future and what we are seeing in the future and what the impact is going to be on women and women in the labor force. Is there any forecasting? Part of that is demographic, but part of it is some of the work that the research team at DWS has been taking a look at. So not just where we are now, but what is the best information about where we are going as a state, and what is the impact on that, on the potential impact on women in a lot of these areas that we're addressing. Thank you for that time.
Thank you. I just wanted to maybe make a comment
to remember it.
It was back when you were talking about these low-paying jobs where women end up on needing assistance for the necessities because the wage just isn't high enough. And maybe this is for Ms. Nain and Workforce Services, but I'm not as familiar with this as I probably should be. But what is the what are the requirements? So I know there's requirements to get certain assistance. You have to be working on a resume or applying, so many applications a week, those kinds of things. What kind of credit, right, can happen if a woman's in education? Are there barriers in terms of you can only get the help, the assistance, if you're actually working or if you're looking for a job or whatever, or can you get the assistance if you're in school? Right? What are the, are there policies, are there things there that are maybe discouraging women from the educational attainment that will lead to the higher paying job?
I think I understand what you're saying. There are, I'm not the expert in our agency on this. I know a little, I can speak to the fact that pursuing education for some programs is considered positive in that you're participating,
right,
and therefore it supports your ongoing use of that. But there are limitations, there's time limits to it. There's also sometimes not the full amount of support you need. For example, you're a single mother with children, and yes, we'll pay for you, help you pay to go to school, but we aren't paying adequate childcare for you to attend your courses.
But
so,
but there would be assistance if you were working for the childcare.
You see what I'm saying?
Exactly.
I do.
So we actually, there's more of a benefit, or there's to keep working at a lower paying job as opposed to providing the benefits so that the woman can go to school and therefore in a year or 2 years, whatever, get a much better paying job and not need the assistance anymore.
I would like to, if you guys don't mind, add that to an upcoming meeting to have our experts come in and look at that. We have already requested that the child care office do this, and the child care director is working on it, but I think now your questions actually expand the scope of what the expertise we need. So I'd like to reach out to
those. Those are the things that as policymakers, that those are action items. Those are things that policies can be changed, waivers can be asked for, whatever it takes in order to focus. So much of the focus on policymakers is, well, encourage work, right? And so you provide the benefit or the assistance when someone's working or working towards working, those kinds of things. And the value of the education, which is actually a long-term solution, much longer-term solution, isn't always encouraged, right? I mean, this is why you have to, people don't generally understand that tax policy is a reflection of the behaviors that government wants people to do, right? That's why there's a child tax credit, right? Encourage child perpetuation of the species, right? I mean, there's a marriage deduction, whatever, because marriage is a stabilizing factor for society, right? So you have, a lot of tax policy, in fact, most of tax policy is a reflection of behaviors, societal behaviors, cultural behaviors that you want to encourage or discourage. You want to encourage charitable giving, so you give a deduction for that. You want to encourage home ownership, so you have a mortgage deduction. All these kinds of things. So what do we have policies that encourage work, but which is good, but don't encourage education, which may be better or just as good, right? Or maybe better. So that's kind of where I'm heading with that one.
I'd like to
from that and hold on to
the experts.
Absolutely. Representative Seeley? I'm sorry, did you have anything more, Ms. Bolger?
Just one more comment, which is that I think our economy will always need unskilled workers. And even though the long-term goal for women would be to be well-educated and to be able to command a higher wage, I think that because we will need unskilled workers at some level, my concern about that is that for the workers at that level, if they can't support themselves, then that will require government help. And is there a way in which we need to think about lifting that up in such a way that those wages can go farther to help families earn their success and be self-reliant? I'm concerned about the trapping of families and then blaming them for being trapped because they can't do anything on $7.25 an hour. So I realize that that's a huge political hot potato, but if there's a way in which we can talk about the way in which we're structuring wages that is entrapping people and also requiring the public benefits that so many people become upset about.
So this is a perfect example of everyone sees the issue, sees the challenge, but have different ways of looking at the solution. Right? So my political leanings are more towards I'm not opposed to the assistance, but let's assist in a way that leads not to continued low wage in perpetuity, but the education that lifts people out of that completely. So let's assist women to have a long-term, lifelong solution to this issue.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Speaker, Chair. So, a couple things. I'm concerned about the conditions of leadership in organizations, so that would be on like corporate boards, and the data's already out there with us, we're really bad as a state. We know that it's bad politically. I don't know if there's a nexus to this with that as well. So the research is already there, the measures are already there. I'm not sure of partners yet with that. Or potential solutions, like maybe best practices in other areas where they've done initiatives. I know mentorship has something to do with it, but I don't know specifically the details of any particular program or maybe has worked on that. So I don't know yet. That's a question mark. I would also like to look at terminal degrees and certification, because education is one thing, but do we allow the opportunity for people to have lifelong learning so they can get an increase in a designation? And for example, a nurse can potentially start out, on one level and then increase his or her educational attainment to gain other levels, which would result in more pay or different areas of expertise. That is a problem in some areas because related to how those professional certificates or designations go, the accumulation of continuing education requirements may not be flexible. Professional licensure may not be flexible insofar as, like, due to tenure, I take a break, does that mean I lose my professional license and have to start all over again? There are things with how we license that we need to take a look at as well. Part of that is like flexibility of class offerings too. That's all I got right now. I know that Ms. Barnett had added, I think I know, I may have made this up. Ms. Barnett added some stuff to the matrix. I'd like to hear during the discussion, what it is that you added from a labor perspective. Thank you.
So I've got three lights here, so I think we're going to start with Ms. Iris.
Thanks, Speaker. Madam Speaker, I communicated this via email to Carrie to add it to the matrix, and she recommended that I bring it up to the commission today. Well, I would like, if possible, another line item under conditions. Representative Seelig just touched on this also, but to put some wording around it, I was thinking something like the condition is underrepresentation of women in leadership positions, both in the private and public sector. I have to bring up the press that this state has received this week regarding the worst state for women. As the commission that is addressing those issues, I don't think that we can, I know it's on the agenda for next meeting, but we have to bring it up today to some extent. One of the main things that they were measuring in that is leadership of women in those states, and we need to, as this commission, address that, I think, as a top priority. I was thinking even going so boldly as to say that we could have organizations like the Governor's Office of Economic Development, perhaps when we're talking to companies about coming to Utah before we offer tax incentives and other incentives to come to Utah, that we actually ask for data regarding how many women they have on their boards or how many women that they have in executive leadership positions to make them accountable for that measure before coming and doing business in our state. We can also, there is an organization, Women Who Run, in Utah that we can partner with to get more women in politics. I think that would be another critical item that we could look at addressing with through partnerships. And like I mentioned, there's an initiative that I'm working closely on at my organization to really lead the way when it comes to women in leadership in the in at least publicly traded companies in Utah. And more to come on that.
Thank you for that. This, what you brought up in terms of GOED and recruiting businesses here, or, you know, when you're looking at incentives, incentives are try not to be too political. Businesses, companies have to behave in certain ways to get an incentive. That's why they get them. And so that may be what you brought up in terms of women representation on their boards and their leadership positions, maybe something that we should put to not only GOED but to the legislature in particular, because it's the legislature that sets many of the, not all, but many of the conditions of the incentive. So, appreciate that input. Is this Ms. Strong? Is that your right?
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
That's fine. Thank you. I would just like to encourage us, as we're thinking about the condition on educational attainment, the solution that we have listed up there is leveraging Utah Futures, and that was talked about at our last meeting as really a tool to move high school students into college. That is primarily the issue. But we have a bigger issue in our state, and that's women who enter college but don't complete. So I just encourage us to look deeply at that.
I appreciate Dr. Robinson's point, and I wanted to make note that my solutions here are what I had gathered from past meetings. Please add, subtract, delete, correct me. Absolutely. These aren't thought of as a, and I tried to signify that there by putting a number one and saying dot, dot, dot. We've got to have more here. So please continue. The more I get on the solutions, Ms. Irene, having not only a condition but a solution, very, very helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Speaker
Lockhart.
Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Thank you, Speaker Lockhart, Madam Chair. On your matrix, we changed a little bit of verbiage. We put construction occupations, but also under the measures, And I say Carrie. First of all, I have to say Carrie. I'm one of these people who love people to email me right back. Oh my golly, you knock it out of the park. And I know you're busy, trust me. And I really do appreciate that. But under measures, I'm going to be striking out the union membership. You do not need to belong to a union in order to be under a collective bargaining agreement. You do not need to belong to a union, although I would encourage it, being a 40-year member myself. But in this state, you do not. But under that collective bargaining agreement, you may be able to get the same wages as a man doing the same work. So I will be striking and changing that, and I didn't get to that church. I was in Connecticut with my grandbaby. And under solutions, the solution for this matrix down here would be to complete a JTPA apprenticeship program with a certificate in any of the non-traditional crafts. And also, the other solution is to educate the young women in the high schools, even in the junior high schools, of the alternatives to an education in one of the crafts, the non-traditional jobs, which pay benefits and a nice retirement as well. Thank you.
Thank you. I agree that so much of girls just aren't aware. They just aren't exposed to the options and aren't aware of what's possible. Thank you very much. Ms. Thompson, is that yours?
Yeah.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My comment is about the third one down on the women lack access to capital for business. That is only one way of funding a business, so there might be things we need to address as well. Not all businesses need to have a loan to begin, but that's one part that we have started with. Also, on the measures, not just dollar value, but also the number of loans that are approved or have been funding, total dollar amount, but also how many were accepted versus maybe those that were applied for. And as far as the partners in the Salt Lake Chamber would probably, I represent the Salt Lake Chamber, especially the Women's Business Center, but it might be more helpful for us to partner with lending institutions to find this information as opposed to a chamber of members, although they do work with many of them, I would suggest, especially the Science Bank, Women's Financial Group, and others such as that, the ones that do lending, as well as angel investor venture capitalists as well. And also possibly business resource providers as well. They do and are required to submit impact numbers, generally, depending on their funding. And those numbers imperative to their funding for their services. We have to track how much of the access to capital our clients were able to access during the time that they were within our services. So those are some of the additional partners we could use to gain more access to funding of businesses. Thank you.
Okay, great. Are there any others? I don't see any more lights. Ms. May, do you have any comments or anything to what you've written? Any questions about anything that anybody said?
No, I don't think I have any questions right now. I've taken some notes, and I'd like to spend the next week or so translating those from comments and notes to items on the matrix. I request that from those who gave me suggestions, if you wouldn't mind collaborating with me via email when I do put these items into the matrix for feedback, and I will keep the group updated, letting you know when things have changed and requesting additional feedback. Thank you very much. This is exactly what this matrix needs, is everyone's voice, and I really feel like we're getting down the road of turning this into a commission tool. So thank you very much for your participation, everyone.
Thank you, and Representative Stephen.
So as part of the solutions, or part of what occurred to me, poor Jen Jankowski to my left is going to start this. And it depends on whether or not the person that takes my place from our caucus wants to continue doing it too, although I feel very confident that she will. Is that Jen's going to start looking at bills that have been introduced that are public that may have any intersection with any of these items that we're talking about, either from a helpful or not helpful standpoint, just to see, do a landscape of what's out there and how different people may be addressing issues that impact any of what it is that we're trying to achieve. That would be an opportunity, definitely an opportunity for some action steps at some point, either for good or bad. So, no, for all good. It's all good, regardless of whether or not what the action is. So we can report back on our initial findings then as well, too.
I just wanted to add to that that much of the feedback that Ms. Burkholder gave regarding poverty issues, I see so much overlap with the intergenerational poverty movement. I know that Senator Reed's vision was to have that focus on children, and so much of the legislation coming out of it is focused on children. I wonder if we can't look for opportunities to expand using the same messaging and the same momentum to include support of women. We've tried to emphasize in my partnership with them that it's women and adults who raise these children who are in poverty, so they need the support as well. I think there may be opportunities for us to correlate with that movement.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question in terms of follow-up with Utah Futures. From last time, we heard a lot of good information, had robust conversation, and they're listed a lot in the solutions column. Is there anything that the commission itself needs to do at this point to advance their work, support their work? Does anyone have a sense of that? I don't want that to completely drop, but I'm not quite sure what we want to do with that information. So I simply raise that.
Yes, sort of. And I would hope Ms. Bain would help with that as well, too. So based on the energetic and robust discussion that we had last meeting related to the potential of Utah Futures to help us meet our goals in a very real, concrete, and short-term way, we had invited Tammy Piper back, but she was unable to come during this meeting. And I just want to make sure that the commitment from the group that presented to us, that we follow through on that and learn what's going on with that endeavor. It's my understanding that the governor's putting together his budget, and when will that be released? Speaker?
I believe it's the 15th of December that it has to be out.
So in many
ways, before then.
Yes, and we will know for sure publicly if and in what form, if it is so, the governor's budget will be supporting Utah Futures. So that would include not only an advocacy for a certain funding amount, but also a location of where Utah Futures would be housed. We heard as part of the discussion that it could be in several places, maybe DWS or maybe directly out of the governor's office or whatever. So that is something that we definitely need to follow up on. If anyone else has anything to add to that, I welcome them too.
Yeah. A question I have based on that information. My boss, Deputy Director of DWS, was willing to come to our next meeting to talk about the budget of Utah Futures and the structure of it. Would that make sense to have him come to the November meeting, or would we just want to wait until the governor's budget comes out and we know
the future of Utah Futures before we talk to anyone.
Well, didn't the legislature appropriate some money to Utah Futures this last session?
I believe so. I think it was one-time money.
Yeah, one-time money. So it would probably, whether or not we have the information on what the governor's proposal is going to be for Utah Futures, I think it would be helpful for us to know the money that was already appropriated, what's happening with that, what the plan is for that.
We'll have him on the agenda then and have him walk us through that.
That'd be great. Thank you. And then we can maybe anticipate what might be coming next. Not knowing, but you know, what might be proposed by the governor's office.
Representative?
In addition to the funding level, there was also the Ms. Irene had brought up the point about potentiality for public-private partnering, maybe, with Utah Futures. So if we get a better idea of where it's even going to be housed, we can start thinking about that strategic relationship and how we can make that happen. So that would equally be helpful. Dollars and geography. Please.
I know that the legislative fiscal analyst may have some information specific to the appropriation. What was the intention of the appropriation this last session for Utah Futures? So you might want to.
I can follow up.
All right. Thank you for that really, really good discussion and all of the ideas and the input on the matrix. And thank you, Ms. Main, for all of your work on that. It's really, really helpful. Okay, item number four, the role of the subcommittees and future and the future of the commission. That's 2014. This is mainly...
Yeah.
Go for it.
Go quite land. So related to subcommittees, of course, until we get the matrix fleshed out, it doesn't really make sense to develop subcommittees because they are a tool, not an entity in and of themselves without meaning or purpose. However, one thing has come up that we do need to start thinking about that we touched on at the beginning of the meeting was communication. And that could also encompass policy communications because after the December meeting, I don't know, I mean, I would hope that the group could get together before the legislative session in January. And in particular, if there's particular funding requests that, for which we want to advocate, like Utah Futures, in an organized way, or if there are particular bills that come up that we either want to support or oppose or provide expertise to, those are things that we need to watch, and those realities change very quickly. So to wait a month for a commission meeting with that could be, we could miss a lot of opportunities. So if you all can think about, please, the potential of forming even a communications subcommittee prior to that, I think that would be very, very uber smart. And then I would ask that the speaker talk about maybe what it is. I mean, because the way that the legislation was written, and I didn't think about this at the time, I just wanted it to get through, was the fact that we can serve on subcommittees. There's no, this committee can design whatever it wants to do related to subcommittees. I left that broad with intention. And whoever can be on that. Our membership as legislators will end December 31st, and I appointed the speaker, and the speaker appointed me because we each get an appointment. In order for continuity to happen, we're thinking about how to create a seamless experience with that so that this commission doesn't miss a beat. Right? Okay, yes, that is a priority of ours. And also with people who will be equally as passionate and adamant about it as well, too. Because we could have designed the best infrastructure in the world, but if the personalities aren't there to help drive this, that are equivalent with what every single other member of this committee has exhibited and why, in large part, you were chosen to be on here, then it'll just be a hindrance to you. And we're committed to not having that happen. So please know that we're there on that. Would you like to add anything else on that, Speaker, Chair, person?
No, other than both of us continue in our roles as Speaker of the House and Minority Leader up until I remind people of this midnight on the 31st of December. So, but we will be looking to replace ourselves to each other, not being able to continue to serve as legislators on the commission. And so, if you have some ideas or something to like, or well, please let us know.
They do have to be legislators. One appointment is made from the Speaker and one is made from the Minority Leader, and they do have to be elected people within the House. Okay. Dr. Robinson has a personal ask for all of us.
Oh, great. Please. I do, and it's fun. All I have to say is Mission Ferris Bueller, and it just... Doesn't that make you a little happy? Like, it has to be fun if you're talking about Ferris Bueller.
In a fake sick day or something?
Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. And I'm asking for your help. Mission Ferris Bueller is an opportunity that I got involved with to give back to our troop station in Afghanistan. I had this great chance in July to attend the U.S. Army War College, which is the premier war college that our colonels attend, and these gentlemen and women will be the next leaders of the U.S. military. I spent a week there doing leadership training, and out of that grew some really nice relationships with a couple of men that were in the group, and a civilian in the group of women. And we, the civilian and I, decided to support our seminar leader, who was, his next assignment was in Afghanistan. He is there, he's leading up a unit of 100 men and women, and they do military intelligence for the Middle East. We committed to send a care package to 100 people in his unit. And my office and a group of people in Minnesota are helping with this. I have made a bet with my office that if they help fill these 100 care packages, I will do something along the lines of sing like Ferris Bueller does, or do a little video. So I'm asking for a little help, and this is where you come in, Speaker Lockhart. There is.
I already did the unexpected challenge.
No. This is painless.
Oh, okay.
There's a great scene in Ferris Bueller where his teacher is saying,
Bueller.
Yes. I am asking that we record you in the commission people, and you're saying Robinson, and we videotape it, and then it's going to go into about a 3-minute video of me skipping out of work to go to a Real game.
Sure.
Your game. Can we do it in the next meeting?
Absolutely.
That's fine. And then I'm going to post this video, and it's going to be sent along with the 100 care packages to our guys in Afghanistan. Okay.
Do you need any help with the care packages?
We would love some help, and I could send out the list. It's really simple things these guys are asking for, because there's not a decent PX near them. So they're asking for things like toothpaste, deodorant, soap, shampoo. And I'm glad to share it with you.
Please do.
Okay, thank you. I really appreciate your support and your willingness to sit in on the video for a second.
If you're not, for whatever reason, if you're not comfortable being on camera for that, just let us know.
Yeah, it's be a requirement or whatever.
By any means.
Is this you, for Holden, that you went? No?
Me.
Oh, it's you. Sorry.
It's me. For night, you. Thank you. This is completely off the agenda. I just want to ask your input on this. Do you like this format? Thank you. Also, thank you. Appreciate that, because I like circles because it creates an energy about us. The other, I'm sorry, I know. I come in this room a lot during the legislature, and, you know, I can't see you, and I can't see your face, and I can't see you. Okay, so that's something. And the other thing is, do we meet during the legislature? So we won't be meeting in here anyway. Are we going to meet, or are we just going to break for 45 days?
I don't think there's anything that prevents the commission from meeting during the legislature. Is there a not having the legislation in front of me, is there a meeting limit, a number of meetings for this year?
Oh, it's a minimum.
A minimum requirement.
A minimum required what?
Oh, yeah, a minimum required number of meetings.
Okay.
What about budget? Is there a meeting that would,
yeah, small amount of money.
And that
could
be
WS for 55K. But it doesn't, it's not tied to any individual.
It's not tied to the
individual. Are you sure? What are you doing?
It goes to the GWS black hole.
No.
Okay, so there's nothing in the legislation that I'm aware of that we're aware of that would prevent the commission from meeting during the session. I'd have to check with the House and the Senate in terms of the legislative space, but there are times during the day that the committee rooms aren't being used. But there are other rooms that are more conducive. They don't have necessarily all the sound system that's in these rooms, in the committee rooms, but I will, just as a personal note, I have never liked these rooms. Since the restoration of the Capitol, I think that they are incredibly pretentious and intimidating to the members of the public who come here. It's really, believe it or not, even as the Speaker of the House, even as when I was assistant whip and leadership in the House, when I would come to a committee and present a bill and sit at the table where the public sits, it is incredibly intimidating. And I cannot imagine what it feels like as a member of the public to sit there, because of the way that these rooms are designed. There's nothing that can be done about it at this point. But I agree with you. These rooms are, some of the committee rooms, 445 is a little bit better. It's a little more in a U where the members of the committee can see each other. This one's not so good that way. But yeah, I'll just reinforce your.
Okay.
I agree with you. These rooms are not necessarily conducive to working together, nor are they very welcoming to the public.
Okay. So that being said, I know that I felt very important, and I'm on this commission, and I went back to, you know, I felt so separated from my colleagues, and I felt that if I were being, you know, some people saw me with my hair on the TV and everything. I just didn't feel like I'm speaking for the people, for my women. And I know that the senator thought this would be great. I mean, this is a great space for us, and it you know, maybe makes us be more parliamentary, you might say. But ladies, come on. I was on the Lieutenant Governor's Commission for Volunteers, and we would sit in here. We sat around there and chat. That was wonderful. So anyway, but if you guys love it, fine.
One of the things we have to be cognizant of is the Open and Public Meetings Act and the ability to record the meetings, all those things. So as long as those things are taken care of, really wherever we are, that's conducive to getting the work of the commission done is really, that's really the goal.
I'm the only one, maybe the voter.
Yeah. So we'll talk with members of the commission. Representative Seeley.
Yeah, I would propose a compromise on that because I understand very well space and what that does. We also have a really, really important role here. And particularly since culturally a lot of times when women get together, it's called a sewing circle. And not in a good way. And I want to make sure that the importance of what it is that you're talking about is reflected in the space as well. So, how about with, is it 445? Which one is that?
That's the EAC one. On the end. The big one. Executive appropriations.
What about in the Senate? I mean, because there. What about in the Senate?
There are Senate rooms. There's also rooms in the House that are much more U-shaped. That are much more conducive to a committee or a commission discussion.
Okay, so let's look at those. And not, I mean, I don't want to go back to the cafeteria. And again, related to the sound system, that's not there. So we'll work on it.
Okay, any other comments or questions from the commission? Seeing none. Representative Seeland.
I'd like to move that we adjourn.
Motion is to adjourn. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay.
Do we have a second?
Nope.
Really?
Well, we don't in the legislature.
I don't know, as a member of the minority party, I don't have an opportunity to chair committees. In some states, they do.
The legislature, no matter what party you are from, you do not need a second. Do you want me to explain why?
No.
Because, and this is for the minority. The reason you don't need a second in the legislature is because no matter who you are as a member of the legislature, your constituents deserve to be represented, and your idea deserves to be brought forward. If you always have to require a second, then your idea could be stopped by no one seconding your motion or your idea. So that's why you don't need a second. It's actually a protection of the minority, not just the minority party, but the minority view. Whatever that might be. So,
that was one more thing.
That's fine. We are adjourned. Thank you all.
Collaborative and not very clear about the issue.